coming up on The Green from Delaware Public Media. The Christina School District tries again to get residents behind a tax referendum to bolster its budget. We look at what district officials are doing to turn the tide in their favor. Memorial Day is the unofficial start of summer, but public health officials say overdoing that fun in the sun can put you at risk for skin cancer.
We want people to be able to relate and say, oh no, you know, I was an avid tanner. Maybe I use tanning beds and I really need to get myself thinking about this. So we really want to change people's mindset.
We learn more about the state's Protect Your Skin DE campaign. And Delaware held its first ever beauty pageant for single mothers last week.
There's so much deeper meaning to being in this pageant than just being up on stage and showcasing a gorgeous dress.
Our Eli Chen takes us there in this week's Enlighten Me. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. We also check in on the First State housing market and learn more about bee colony loss locally. Next on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground. But first, the news from NPR. Welcome to this week's edition of The Green. I'm your host, Tom Byrne. In February, residents in the Christina School District offered a resounding no to a pair of tax referendum plans from the district. A smaller keep the lights on proposal that would have filled an anticipated $9 million budget gap was defeated by almost 4,000 votes, while a larger tax increase that would have also funded new initiatives was rejected by about 4,500 votes. The district has already announced $1.8 million in cuts in response to that defeat, and more could be coming if a new referendum before voters Wednesday fails. The goal of the new plan? Maintain the programs the district has in place with no new initiatives. Contributor Larry Nagengast looks at this second attempt to garner support for a tax hike to pay the district's bills in his piece online at DelawarePublic.org. And he joined me this week to tell me a little bit more about what he found.
What is the district looking for in this referendum, and is it radically different from the previous one that failed so miserably back in February?
Yeah, there is quite a bit of difference to this one, Tom. This time around, the school district is looking for a tax increase for operating expenses of 37 cents per $100 of assessed valuation, and it would be spread over 3 years. The bulk of the increase, 28 cents per $100, would go into effect if the referendum is passed this year, and then 5 cents additional in the second year, and another 4 cents in the third year for the total of 37. Compare that with the February referendum when the district was asking for actually two different things. First, a 65 cent increase spread over 3 years that they said would sustain current programs, and 40 cents on top of that for new programs, and that would have been spread over 4 years. So essentially the district is asking for less money now to keep itself going than it was asking for in February.
In retrospect, is the amount of the ask why it failed last time, or do district officials and other people you talk to feel that there were other reasons why the referendum last time went so poorly for Christina?
It was both. There's no doubt in hindsight that asking for 65 cents per hundred was just way too much for the district's residents to swallow. So that was definitely a mistake. And then when you threw on top of that this second question about 40 cents per $100 for new programs, this added a layer of confusion. People weren't quite sure what they were voting for. Was it voting for A or voting for B, or could you vote for yes or one, no on the other, whatever. It was a very confusing process. Layered on top of that, there were all sorts of issues going on and coming to a head in Christina in February. There was the issue of priority schools and what would happen to these half dozen district schools that had poor performance that could be taken over by the state, could be turned into charters, could possibly be moved into the Red Clay School District. All of that was in play. And then on top of that, if you recall, the governor was talking about cutting in half a tax break for senior citizens on their school taxes, which made senior citizens even less likely to be willing to vote for a tax increase. So, I mean, there was an awful lot of things going on in Christina at the time. Some of the things were poorly done, the administration and the school people admit, and some of it were, you know, situations that were somewhat beyond their control. But anything that could have gone wrong, that had the potential to, you know, not shoot down a referendum in February, was there. All the conditions were bad then. Generally speaking, things, you know, not that things are a whole lot better now, but you know, some of those issues have gone away or moved into the background.
And so, in a lot of ways, what your piece suggests is that they've done a big job kind of rebranding this whole ask. And a big part of that rebrand effort is including charter schools, which apparently is a fairly unique idea, you're saying.
Well, yeah, it is a fairly unique idea, and it was also a, you know, a pretty big issue. When the vote was held in February, the district officials were, to some extent, complaining and saying, this is kind of a regrettable situation. We've got 4,400 students who live in our district who are going to charter schools, and this is costing us money. And then we've got a net loss of 700 students to other districts via the choice program. So all this tax money that we're collecting is going to other districts because the money follows the student. They've gotten more than a little bit different this time around. The referendum's brand or slogan is Christina Charter Choice, We All Win. And the point here is rather simple. If Christina residents vote to increase their property taxes, that's going to mean that if your child goes to a charter school, there's going to be more money that the district is going to send to the charter school to support that student. And likewise, if you choice your child into a school in another district, it's going to mean more. The figure the district is putting out is something like $633. So if you've got a child who's in a charter school or is choosing to another district and you're a Christina resident, if you vote for the referendum, the reasoning goes, that's going to mean more money that's being sent from your tax dollars from Christina to the district or to the charter that your school attends, which is going to mean better programs, better whatever, at those schools.
So is there a sense that either charter or choice parents either weren't motivated to vote at all or would vote against it because they felt like they'd be paying for something that wasn't affecting their child?
It's hard to tell. I mean, Kendall Massett at the Delaware Charter Schools Network says, we charter school parents weren't the reason that they lost the last referendum. And she says charter school parents aren't going to be the reason that this referendum passes, if it does. But, certainly that's a factor. I mean, the way the district officials played it in February, they were, in essence, creating a split. Because they were putting down to some extent the mm-hmm. loss of students to charters and choice, it didn't leave a good taste in the mouth of those families.
So maybe they don't vote or they vote no.
Right, exactly. And not necessarily because they don't really understand, and they never were in a position to understand that a yes vote could conceivably mean more for their schools as well. So they've turned it around this time. The strategy seems to make sense. Some of the charter school officials that I've spoken to certainly think so. We're going to benefit from this if people vote for it. So they like the idea. I think the district obviously feels that this is a strategy, a tactic that's going to give them a better chance of securing passage. And it really hasn't been done before in any significant way, because all the charters are chartered by the state, except for in the Red Clay District, which mm-hmm. has had a couple of referendums and hasn't made a big point of soliciting charter parents. But this is kind of a new approach, and will be interesting to see how it does play out.
But as you noted, it's not likely that those charter parents are going to be the difference in whether this passes or fails. And a lot of times what we've seen in the past, the difference is whether or not the district puts together an organized, energized campaign, that they are out in front of it. What is Christina doing in that regard to, you know, kind of get out the vote?
Well, as you say, the campaign this time around is definitely more organized. It's more energized. They created a number of committees dealing with marketing, dealing with communication, public education, that sort of thing. They dealt. They created subcommittees at each school building, so that you've got teachers and staff and parent volunteers at each building, coordinating referendum efforts and getting out the vote, making the phone calls. They're going door to door. In addition to making phone calls, they're doing it in Wilmington, in the city portion of the district, as well as the suburban portion of the district. And from what I'm hearing, the folks who are involved in the campaign are all enthusiastic, and they think that they're getting, generally favorable responses. Hard to tell, and certainly in any sort of school vote, the number of people that votes is relatively small in terms of the overall population eligible voters. But there's certainly more optimism this time around than there was in February.
Is this effort maybe even more important in terms of organization and energy in Christina because of some of those other issues you were talking about earlier, the priority schools and things like that, that tended to muddy the waters, that you really need to directly get people focused on this if you're going to have any chance of success?
I think, yeah, you're absolutely right about that. I mean, these other issues, the priority schools issue, for example, I mean, it's not going to entirely go away, but whatever happens in terms of priority schools and possible redistricting, all of that stuff is 2 or 3 years down the road. The issue right now is that Christina officials say they need the money in order to keep things going just as they are right now, and this is a relatively small ask when you look at the amount of money that's involved. The average home in the district after 3 years would be paying $20 more per month in property taxes. For some people that's a significant amount, but it's certainly not a huge increase. It is important that they get keep the focus on the fact that these are immediate needs in order to sustain what they have right now, and to let people know, remind them that the long-term issues that the district is facing are issues that are not going to be resolved for a couple of years, and they can't wait for those issues to be solved before they put a little bit more money into the district.
Having said all that, the last time a 4,000 vote margin against the referendum from the people you're talking to, do they feel like they can make that margin up?
They're talking like they can. I've just got to be skeptical because I mean there's so much of a difference. Having lost by essentially a 3-1 margin the last time around, to turn it around this time, I think that that's going to be somewhat difficult. But then the history in Delaware has been, and it's not quite true in all the cases, but when a school district makes a request for an operating tax increase, very often the first try will fail and they'll come back a couple of months later with a significantly smaller request and they'll get it through. That's just a general pattern that has occurred more often than not over the last 15, 20 years in the state. And if you want to look at that particular pattern, I think you can say that they've got a pretty good chance, because that's the tactic that they're following here.
Our thanks to Larry Nagengast for his time this week. Again, his piece on the Christina School District referendum is online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Next up on The Green, spring usually means the housing market heats up. What's the lay of the land in the first state for buyers and sellers? We take a look with contributor Eileen Dalabrida. This is Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Spring is a time when the housing market traditionally heats up, but in recent years it seemed to be more of a simmer than a full boil. How about this year? What are the prospects for buyers and sellers in the first state now? This week, contributor Eileen Dalabrida took a look and found there are some indications that more houses are moving, but prices may not be gaining ground as quickly. You can find her piece right now at DelawarePublic.org, and she joins us to talk a little bit more about the housing market here in the first state. Eileen, thanks for being with us this week.
Hi, Tom.
Well, let's start with, as I mentioned, there seems to be some good news, and at least when you're looking at the volume of houses moving, what are we seeing locally in terms of the quantity of houses that are being sold, and are there some areas in the state that are maybe stronger than others at this point?
We're seeing a definite uptick in the number of properties that are changing hands, and some regions are indeed more popular than ever. It probably isn't much of a surprise that very fashionable dresses like Greenville are ticking up. But what might be a little bit surprising is that homes in neighborhoods in Wilmington in the 19801 zip code are perking up. And also we're seeing a very strong resurgence in sales of vacation and second homes in coastal Sussex County.
Overall, the volume, about how much of an increase are we seeing at this point, broadly?
Well, I would say across the board, it is about 10% more than it has been in recent years. And although some areas are not seeing appreciable increases in prices.
And that's where I was going to go next, the prices, which don't seem to have bounced back quite as well. Where do they stand right now in terms of kind of regaining their footing after that big collapse?
Well, you termed it perfectly, Tom. It was a big collapse. It was huge. And homes lost an average of 23% of their value. And even with this recent activity, we've only regained about 5% of that value. So people who bought at the top of the market are still underwater.
And I guess there's also some issues still with foreclosure, some areas where those things are still a drag on the market, even though we maybe not hear as much about it in the media anymore. It's still a factor, right?
It's a big factor, especially in places like Middletown, which was a definite foreclosure hotspot. More houses are selling now in Middletown, but prices continue to decline. As a matter of fact, the homes in Middletown that sold most recently are selling for an average of 10% less than this time last year.
And I guess that makes it a really tough decision for people who live in those areas who want to sell, because even though their home wasn't in foreclosure, those things have an impact on the price they can get for their home.
They truly do. And that's sprinkled throughout Newcastle and Kent County.
If you're selling, what do you need to do to have success? Because it does seem like it is still a buyer's market at this point, correct?
It is. And fixer-uppers are not as popular as viewers of HGTV would believe. the homes that are selling the fastest are homes that the buyers just need to bring their toothbrush. They're freshly painted. They have upgraded kitchens. They have nice bathrooms. They're nicely landscaped. They're decluttered. They're painted in neutral colors. As a matter of fact, an agent told me that this year's favorite neutral is a color called China Doll. It's a very pale and creamy beige, very, very nice, light, inviting color.
And I guess you also mentioned in your piece that there are some things that maybe people don't necessarily think about having an impact on price, things from landscaping to even, if you smoked in your home.
Odors is a huge turnoff, and it's hard to sell a smoker's home. It's also very difficult to sell homes that have pet odors. So if people who smoke, if you want to sell your house, you have got to go outside.
And I guess that's the thing that people maybe don't necessarily think about, is that there are these little things that do make a big difference that you may necessarily, you immediately think of, well, how soon or how long ago was the roof done? How long ago or how old is the heater? But when push comes to shove, people really do look at these very little things, don't they?
They do. And they're the kinds of things that when you live in a home, you're nose blind to, you don't know, or you're sight blind to, you don't notice those little dings in the paint. But the person who is walking into a property that has never been there before sees those kinds of things immediately.
How about mortgages, Eileen? How tough is it to qualify, and is that having an impact on how quickly houses are moving and what people are capable of buying?
Mortgages from traditional lenders are still tough, but there are a number of government programs that are making it much more accessible for people to get into the market and also to move up in the market. The Delaware State Housing Authority, which for many years had programs only for first-time buyers, now has programs for subsequent buyers. There are income guidelines, but they aren't real stringent. You can earn 120% of the median income in Newcastle County and still qualify for a loan.
And finally, I mean, from those people you talked to for this story, what is, I guess, the general level of optimism for the market and perhaps it continuing this improvement and maybe getting, you know, a little bit closer to what people were maybe used to, maybe not as big as the bubble, but maybe more accustomed to in a regular market?
I think that it is the most optimistic season in years, and that the volume really speaks volumes. And it says a lot about people being willing to commit to a new home, that they're not saying, oh, golly, I need to stay put because I'm worried about my job or I'm worried about the economy, that they're showing more confidence and getting out there. And eventually, prices will follow.
All right. Eileen Dalabrida, we thank you so much for your time this week here on The Green.
Thanks, Tom.
Again, you can see Eileen's piece on the housing market here in the First State right now. It's available at DelawarePublic.org. And stay with us. We look at new numbers on the loss of bee colonies in the state of Delaware. How accurate are they, and what can be done to stem these losses? It's coming up next, but first, the news from Delaware Public Media. Welcome back to The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. A national survey released last week by the Bee Informed Partnership and the USDA showed that beekeepers had lost 40% of their honeybee colonies in the past year. The survey also showed that Delaware had one of the highest rates of colony loss, 61%. But Delaware's state apiarist, Bob Mitchell, has another take on that number. Delaware Public Media's science reporter, Eli Chen, spoke to him to get his perspective.
So according to a report last week that was released on honeybee colony loss nationwide, Delaware was revealed to have actually one of the highest rates of bee colony loss in the country at 61%. Is that number at all surprising to you, or does it match up with what you're seeing out in the field?
It's not surprising. I question the validity of the survey.
Is there a report that you do place validity in?
Well, yes. The National Ag Statistics Survey is usually pretty good. And what I question about the Bee Informed Partnership is the way they collect the data. And we have no way of knowing where that data comes from.
And what are you seeing in the field?
Right now, we are looking at beekeepers preparing to go take their colonies into the field to pollinate crops. They're making up their winter losses, and their things appear to be in pretty good condition.
When colony loss happens, what are some of the challenges that bees are generally up against?
Everything. Honeybees have a lot of pressure from insect pests, parasites, diseases. They face a lot of habitat loss, the forage loss. The forage loss is due to the increase in population in rural areas, loss of bee pasture, and the bee pastures both in terms of variety of plants that are there as well as the acreage. Bees need a very wide range of plant varieties in order to get the wide range of nutrition that they require. It's not just simple plant sugars. takes a lot of other things as well. We see a lot of issues with nutrition with bees.
And recently we had a pretty severe winter. Has that had any impact on the bees?
Absolutely. Absolutely. We had several months that the bees couldn't get out to forage. Normally we get warm spells where the bees can go out, take cleansing flights. This year we did not have that. So that put a lot of pressure. It was also cold when the bees started to daylight length got long increased, got longer daylight lengths. The queen started laying. The reproduction is what consumes most of the energy in the hive, the honey and pollen stores. And so we had a lot of colonies starved to death actually trying to reproduce.
So I just want to get down to brass tacks and help people understand what exactly a lost bee colony looks like. How does a beekeeper know that a bee colony is lost?
Well, the beekeepers make periodic inspections of the colonies, and they usually inspect them prior to the winter season and during the winter season and then in the springtime. And they'll notice very easily to notice the food consumption levels and the food levels in the colonies, and they try to feed in the winter time to help them have enough food to survive to the springtime. So when they get to colonies, sometimes they just perish due to one of many reasons, and they'll find them sometimes that just perish.
And what does a beekeeper do when they find out that a colony has been lost? What do they do then?
Well, generally they'll inspect it, make sure it's not from a disease problem. They'll take the equipment and make increases for the next season and fill it back up with more bees.
And on Tuesday, President Obama actually announced the first national strategy to promote the health of honeybees and other pollinators. Do you think, you know, as a state apiarist, do you think actions like these are encouraging, and do you think you'll have much of an impact?
We certainly hope so. Yes, it looks like it is a very workable strategy, and if we can encourage people to participate, I think it will help.
No matter what the numbers, scientists and environmentalists alike have noted that along with more federal funding and scientific research, there is a strong need for public engagement to make life better for bees. Eli Chen also spoke with Bill Leitzinger, head of the Newcastle County Beekeepers, to learn more about what his group is doing to share its enthusiasm for bees with the public.
Bill Leitzinger, you are the chief drone of the Newcastle County Beekeepers. When you and your fellow beekeepers go to festivals and school classrooms, what do you tell people to emphasize how important bees are to our lives?
A lot of the misconceptions about honeybees is that the main thing that they do is produce honey for us humans, and that's the most important agricultural job that they do. But in fact, the most important by far job that they do is that they pollinate one-third of our crops. And if you're eating fruit, vegetables, and a lot of other products, honeybees are the reason that you're allowed to have these on your plate. And so many people think it's all about the honey, but really it's about pollination. Farmers in this country could not survive, could not produce the yield of crops without the assistance of honeybees.
Bob Mitchell mentioned in our conversation earlier that bees in Delaware had a particularly tough time this past winter. So how did your bees do?
I went into winter with five hives, and I have three left. So I lost two hives over the winter, which is about maybe average. People think that 100% of the hives come through the winter, but oftentimes you'll lose one or two hives. So I think that's pretty normal. I'm not unsatisfied with what happened over the winter.
Right. And how, as a beekeeper, do you recoup those losses?
Well, the interesting thing about the honeybee is they help you recoup those losses every year. Their natural inclination is to swarm, and you've seen the big swarms on TV that look scary, but actually they're not. Their alarm pheromones turned off when they swarm, so they're not very aggressive. But the swarming mechanism allows bees to expand, and so when the hive gets too crowded, they swarm. And so what beekeepers do is they create what we call artificial swarms. We'll take a very strong hive that looks like they want a swarm, and we'll split it in two and take half of the food and half the bees and put it in one hive, and then leave the old queen in one hive and have no queen in the second hive. And what happens is the bees will then make their own queen. They'll see that there's no queen in the hive, and they'll start feeding some of the babies what's called royal jelly, which changes the hormones in the growth of the honeybee and turns them into queens.
That's fascinating.
Yeah.
And so not all of us might have the room in our homes or be able to go out and buy a hive of bees. So what are some of the simple things people can do to try and promote and sustain the health of honeybees and other pollinators?
The best thing you can do is to minimize the use of pesticides on your flowers in your garden. You can also look up on the web and find what plants do honeybees like. A lot of people think that all flowers are attractive to honeybees, but actually they prefer the smaller flowers, and there are particular varieties that have more nectar and pollen than others.
And for our listeners who might be interested in joining the Newcastle County Beekeepers, what sort of events can they find you this year, and what meetings can, you know, they attend?
We're part of the Delaware Beekeepers Association, and the Delaware Beekeepers Association has monthly meetings in each county. So there's a Kent County Club, there's a Newcastle County Beekeepers Club, which I'm ahead of, and then there's a Sussex County Beekeepers. Every meeting that we have is open and free to the public. You don't have to be a member to come to our meetings. But we also have events that are special for non-beekeepers. Every summer, we have a table, one of the most popular tables in the Ag Building at the State Fair down in Harrington. And we have live bees there for people to see and kids to see, and we have thousands of visitors during the State Fair. And then in the fall, we have something called the Open Hive. And the Open Hive basically is an opportunity for you, the non-beekeeper, to come look inside a hive. We'll have speakers in the morning, and then near lunchtime, we will go out into the hive, get you suited up, and then we'll open some hives, and you can see inside the beehive. It's a pretty fun, exciting day.
Our thanks to Bill Leitzinger of the Newcastle County Beekeepers, and before that, Delaware State apiarist Bob Mitchell, for joining us this week on The Green. Coming up on The Green, with the unofficial start of summer this Memorial Day weekend, we check in with the Division of Public Health and its campaign to make sure fun in the sun doesn't lead to skin cancer. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media. This is The Green on Delaware Public Media, and I'm Tom Byrne. Memorial Day is the unofficial start of summer, but you can't overdo all that fun in the sun. As we approach the warmer weather, the risk of getting sunburn increases. The American Cancer Society predicts 73,000 cases of melanoma will be diagnosed this year. Skin cancer is the most common type of cancer and can spread if not caught early. About 27 Delawareans die of melanoma annually. But the good news is there are steps you can take to decrease your risk. Health professionals note that protection from the sun's UV rays can prevent 90% of all skin cancer cases. Awareness and education is the goal behind Protect Your Skin DE, a skin cancer prevention campaign from Delaware's Division of Public Health. And this week, Delaware Public Media's Kathy Carter spoke with DPH Cancer Control Program Director Heather Brown to learn more about the initiative.
Heather, unlike other kinds of cancer, the mortality rates are actually climbing for melanoma, but I understand Delaware is actually doing better in terms of rates.
Delaware is doing better. Delaware now ranks 28th in the country in mortality, and we are down from 24th. From the last time period.
What do you attribute to that?
Well, I think that people are really starting to catch on what we've been trying to do as far as educating people of the risk factors and knowing what to look for and seeking checkup from their doctor if something looks suspicious. So the good part is people are catching it early, and then that's making the mortality numbers go down because it's being caught at the time where it's most treatable.
So the good news is there are steps you can take to decrease your risk of
developing. Absolutely.
Okay. What are some of the things that we should all be doing?
Well, if you're spending time outdoors, you should wear a broad-spectrum water-resistant sunscreen with an SPF of 15 or higher, and you should also seek shade. You should reapply sunscreen every few hours or after swimming or sweating. Don't forget the back of your neck and ears. Even people with dark skin should wear sunscreen. No one is immune to skin cancer. Wearing wide-brimmed hats to cover your head, face, neck, and ears. Protecting your eyes with sunglasses that block 99% or more of UV light. Wearing clothing such as long sleeve shirts and pants. We definitely want to avoid tanning beds, booths, and sun lamps, you know, which have also been linked to skin cancer, including melanoma. In fact, it's illegal now as of January 1st, 2015, for anyone under the age of 18 in Delaware to use UV tanning beds or equipment emitting electromagnetic radiation.
Now, Heather, you mentioned that no one is immune to skin cancer, and probably one misconception may be that much of the injury to the skin has already occurred when you're a kid, so that preventive measures are just no longer necessary if you're an older adult.
Yeah, and that's understandable, but it is a misconception. I mean, people with dark skin should be wearing sunscreen. Older adults should wear sunscreen. Everyone should wear sunscreen because it's never too late to develop sunscreen either, or develop skin cancer, I'm sorry, because no one is immune to skin cancer.
And let's talk about the other age groups. Now, kids, obviously hugely important because sunburns during childhood, I imagine they double an individual's lifetime risk of developing skin cancer, at least double.
Yes, children's skin is especially sensitive to UV light, so a few bad burns, just a few in childhood, can increase a child's risk of developing skin cancer tremendously later in life.
And then we get older, and then I imagine that the years between maybe 13 to 22 can be among most challenging because teenagers, they have that peer pressure. They want to look good, and tanning equals looking good.
Yes, yes. So that's correct. I have heard that. But we're also doing some great things throughout the state this summer, starting with going around to different kids' camps to educate children. We're doing a pledge to wear sunscreen in a couple of our high schools throughout the state. So we have students signing the pledge to wear sunscreen throughout the summer of SPF 15 or above, and really making it fun for them and making them aware of, you know, that this can happen. So they want to be protective of themselves now.
So we covered all the age groups and the specific risks to each age group. Now let's talk about what you brought up earlier is the tanning beds. How dangerous are they?
They are really dangerous. I mean, people don't realize that they are the same as the sun. So why would you put yourself in that position? You know, you want to wear sunscreen all the time when you're outdoors. So if you think about then getting in a tanning bed to give yourself a tan and you have no protection, you know, that can be a huge risk you're taking.
How can we get this information out to especially the teen women? I mean, I know it's under 18 you can, but if you're over 18, you can go into these tanning beds. And I'll be honest with you, I went to the gym yesterday and I saw several young ladies going into the tanning beds.
Absolutely. We've done a lot of education. We have a website. It is www.protectyourskinde.com. There's actually a wonderful testimonial speaker on our website that people can view. And the gal, Terry, giving the testimonial, she was an avid tanner. She went to the beach. She went to the tanning bed. And now she's ended up with 7 surgeries on her face due to that.
Yeah, I actually watched these videos. They are very powerful. Is this a way to step up the conversation? Because maybe at some point people kind of tune out. Yes, we know. It's the sun is coming. Skin cancer is bad. And then they stop listening.
Yeah, I mean, we really just need to keep it at the forefront. Delaware is doing better, like I said, but we really want to get the testimonials out. We want people to be able to relate and say, oh, no, you know, I was an avid tanner. Maybe I use tanning beds, and I really need to get myself thinking about this. So we really want to change people's mindset and really realize to protect their skin.
And there's another very powerful testimonial video on the website. A woman whose husband died very young, age 28. He was a farmer and he worked outdoors.
Yes, absolutely. So we want to make sure that anyone who works outdoors, you know, children, men, women, all of us, if we're going to be outdoors, to get that sunscreen on and keep reapplying it.
Well, perfect. So we have this information. Again, the website is protectyourskin.de. Heather Brown, is there anything I haven't asked you that you really want the public to know about this campaign?
The only thing I would say is we are at a bunch of upcoming events. We're going to be at the Pfeiffer Orchards Blueberry Festival. We're going to be at a family fun night at the Brandywine Zoo. We're going to be at the Delaware State Fair. We're going to be at the Pfeiffer Orchards Peach Festival. We'll be giving out sunscreen. We'll be giving out Frisbees that change color in the UV light. We have some great wristbands for kids that change color in the UV light that they can alert their parents, hey, I need sunscreen when it turns purple. So we really are trying to be interactive, and we want to just get the message out.
That's a great way to get the kids involved. Tell us a little bit more about those wristbands and how
they
work.
Absolutely. Oh, they love them. It's funny. They're white when they put them on when they're inside, but even the little bit of sun, even through the clouds, because you can get sunburn on a cloudy day, it lights up to a little faded purple to a bright purple when you really the sun is at its highest and you really need that sunscreen on. So it alerts the parents, too. So it interacts them.
Fantastic. Heather Brown, once again, thank you for sharing all of this with us. Memorial Day weekend is coming up, and it's going to be a beautiful sunny weekend, so obviously people have to take precautions.
Yes, it is. Please be safe outdoors.
And our thanks to the Division of Public Health's Cancer Control Program Director, Heather Brown. Again, the website for information is protectyourskinde.com. Stay with us. We wrap up the show with Enlighten Me, which takes us to Delaware's first ever beauty pageant for single moms. This is Delaware Public Media. Thanks for spending time with us on The Green. I'm Tom Byrne. Traditionally, people think of beauty pageants as competitions among young, physically appealing women. It's not often you come across one where the contestants are mothers, or more specifically, single mothers. But recently, management services company Destined to Be put on a single mom's beauty pageant at Dover Downs, celebrating single moms. And for this week's Enlighten Me, Delaware Public Media's Eli Chen attended the event.
When I enter the ballroom at Dover Downs, the room is blasting with top 40 hits. A curtain-draped runway extends out into the center of the room. Crystal centerpieces and flower bouquets placed on the sides of the stage. Dozens of families are gathered around banquet tables, eating, drinking, making light conversation. Small children are chasing each other between the tables. Everyone is killing time, waiting for the contestants of Delaware's first single mom's beauty pageant to come back on stage.
Ladies and gentlemen, our 2015 Miss Single Mom contestants.
The curtain lifts to reveal 10 contestants wearing evening gowns. This is the very last portion of the event after the talent show and speeches about motherhood. The winner of the statewide Miss Delaware beauty pageant steps out to make an appearance.
And it was so special that Miss Delaware USA, Miss Brene Bull, wanted to be here to crown our new Miss Phenomenal Mom this year.
And singer Sonia Lachelle emerges from the stage to belt out a song. Suffice it to say, there were a lot of emotions cycling through the room. A couple of the contestants were noticeably wiping tears. Afterwards, the host comes back up, preparing to announce the top four contestants. But before she does, she makes sure to emphasize how unique this event is.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is the first year that this has ever been done in the state of Delaware. I doubt if it's ever been done anywhere.
The idea of a single mother's beauty pageant raises eyebrows. That's because many of us see beauty pageants as superficial events that celebrate young, physically attractive women who have yet to build any sizable real-life experience. The women competing at this beauty pageant are being celebrated precisely because they lead tough lives. Candace Jackson, who organized the event on behalf of her management services company, Destined to Be, is a single mom herself. It was her father's death last October that pushed her to start working on this project.
It's in honor of my mother, and it's a tribute to my dad, if that makes sense. My mom is my rock, and I want to always make her proud.
Miss Phenomenal Mom isn't the only award that they're handing out. The day before, the contestants had a luncheon where they handed out scholarships to help contestants planning to attend Wilmington University. And Bissa Smart won the Miss Congeniality Award.
B as in beautiful, okay. I as in intelligent, mm-hmm. S as in sweet, A as in adorable.
Bissa was born in Trinidad and then grew up in Florida, where she participated in beauty pageants when she was younger. Later, she moved to Delaware and had her 3.5-year-old son, Chad, with her now ex-husband.
There's so much deeper meaning to being in this pageant than just being up on stage and showcasing a gorgeous dress. My mission from this point on is to help as many young ladies as possible to recognize how wonderful and how fantastic they are without anyone, without any one of the opposite sex, if you will, needing to recognize them for that, to feel that confidence.
Many of the contestants, like Bissa, effused with inspirational insights like these on stage as well. At the last part of the evening, after the final four women were singled out to be judged, Candace's mother, Helen, delivered the questions.
Christina, as a single mom, how do you promote positive self-esteem and confidence in your children so they can succeed?
To promote and build self-esteem and confidence in my children, I encourage them whenever they do something amazing.
And then, after a period of waiting for the judges to deliberate, the winners were chosen. And Bissa Smart ended up being the winner.
The new 2015 Miss Phenomenal Mom is Miss Bissa Smart.
It's not a bad idea to throw a glamorous event to celebrate mothers. Our culture reminds us all the time how underappreciated they are, and single mothers, even more so. They're the ones who have to give birth to us, and on top of that, take on the daunting responsibility of raising us into hopefully functional members of society. But Bissa has pretty high ambitions.
There are people out there who love you. There are people out there who adore you, respect you, look up to you, continue to do the right thing, because you could be raising the next Barack Obama.
And Candace couldn't be happier with the way it turned out. Her thoughts have not only jumped to Delaware's second annual Single Moms Beauty Pageant, she's also getting requests to put on a Single Dads Pageant. So single fathers, stay tuned. Eli Chen, Delaware Public Media.
And thanks to Eli Chen for enlightening us this week. And that's all for The Green this week. A reminder, the stories and interviews you've heard are online right now at DelawarePublic.org. Just head to The Green's page on our website. If you have comments about this week's show or story ideas for future shows, you can contact us via our Facebook page, on Twitter at TheGreenDE, or by emailing us at TheGreen@DelawarePublic.org. Thanks to all those who helped make today's show possible, contributors Eileen Dalabrida and Larry Nagengast, Delaware Public Media's Kathy Carter and Eli Chen, as well as our station manager, Casey House. For all of them and the rest of the staff here at Delaware Public Media, I'm Tom Byrne. Thanks for joining us, and we'll see you again next week on The Green, where Delaware explores its common ground.